Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine welcome Dr. Robert Udelsman. Dr. Udelsman is the chairman of the Department of Surgery at Yale School of Medicine, and he's an expert on thyroid cancer.
Let's start off with a very basic question, and that is, what is thyroid cancer?
So thyroid cancer is a malignancy that originates in the thyroid gland, and there are several subtypes of thyroid cancer.
And maybe you can get into a little bit about the different subtypes of thyroid cancer?
Of course. So there are four fundamental subtypes of thyroid cancer: papillary, follicular, medullary, and anaplastic. And they're derived from cells that originate in the thyroid gland. I should also mention a primary thyroid lymphoma can also start in the thyroid gland. And in fact, thyroid lymphoma is more common than the rarest type of thyroid cancer, which is anaplastic thyroid cancer.
So can you tell us a little bit about how common thyroid cancer is?
Yeah, actually, thyroid cancer is actually fairly common. But we should step back and think that thyroid nodules are where thyroid cancer develops. And thyroid nodules are very common in the population in America. But there are about 35,000 new cases of thyroid cancer per year in the United States.
Are there any specific risk factors for thyroid cancer?
Yeah, there sure are. One risk factor is radiation exposure as a child, particularly to the head and neck. Although that process is no longer done, for instance, for acne or for thymic enlargement, we still have a new population of patients who have, for instance, mantle of radiation for Hodgkin's disease, and they're at risk for thyroid cancer throughout their lives. In addition, individuals, especially as a child, who are exposed to radiation accidents, for instance, the Chernobyl population, are all at risk for thyroid cancer for the rest of their lives.
Rob, how about, you know, the radiation that, say, for instance, kids and or adults might be exposed to with dental procedures?
Yeah. It's thought that the typical x-rays that individuals get, for instance, for dental procedures or even spine surgery, is not a significant risk factor for thyroid cancers, and those parents should not be overly concerned about that population of patients.
Can we talk a little bit about thyroid nodules, which are very common? Can you tell us how often does a thyroid nodule lead to thyroid cancer?
Yeah. Well, this is a very important and basic concept, that a thyroid cancer probably in almost all cases starts out as a small thyroid cancer that grows. Whereas if you have a thyroid nodule that is benign from the start, it probably remains benign for the entire lifespan of that nodule. So that thyroid nodules can be seen in up to 15% of the normal female population in the United States, but certainly 15% of women in the United States do not have thyroid cancer.
And do thyroid nodules occur more frequently in women than men? Because your answer kind of suggested that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And they sure do. There's about a 3-to-1 ratio female-to-male predominance of thyroid nodules in the female population. Well, it's a strange thing we see. There are other endocrine tumors that also have a female predominance.
And do we know why for thyroid nodules it occurs more frequently in females?
You would think there would be a simple estrogen explanation or a lack of testosterone or some other growth factor. The truth is, we don't really have a clear explanation why they're more common in women than men.
So do all women who have these nodules need to have them biopsied?
Yeah, that's where we get into a little bit of complexity. So what do you do if you have a thyroid nodule? The answer is it sort of depends on how it's found and the size. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, because we do so much screening with ultrasound examinations, we're finding more and more thyroid nodules that are smaller and smaller. And we have a real dilemma in the field. What is the smallest size that indicates that you should biopsy a nodule versus just watching it and monitoring it?
So are most of these nodules picked up by physical exam, or how does one know that one has a thyroid nodule?
Yeah, they come in both ways. So it's not uncommon for someone to say, you know, I was looking at myself in the mirror and I saw some nodule, or my doctor or my gynecologist felt a nodule, and that's how a patient gets referred. It also happens that a patient goes for an incidental ultrasound for a carotid study to make sure they have adequate blood flow for their carotid arteries, and they find an incidental thyroid nodule. We also see that population of patients, and we actually see both types of populations.
And Rob, do these nodules ever cause any alterations in the normal function of the thyroid?
Yeah. So as you know, thyroid hormone is critical for life. It gives you the energy for living. And almost all thyroid cancers are non-functional. They do not make thyroid hormone. But remember, a thyroid nodule is just a thyroid nodule. So for instance, we also see a wide variety of patients with thyroid hormone abnormalities, patients with Graves' disease or hot toxic nodules. These patients do have thyroid hormone abnormalities, but those are not cancers. Mm.
Are there symptoms that a patient would experience if they had a thyroid nodule?
Yeah, so the first symptom would be just a mass. They could feel something in their neck, or they might experience a coughing sensation or difficulty swallowing. Things, advanced symptoms in the setting of thyroid cancer, for instance, pain is an advanced symptom, or a loss of function of a vocal cord such that they develop a hoarse voice. Those are advanced findings of usually advanced tumors.
So if any of these symptoms should be present in an individual, what should they then do?
Yeah, so as in all things, I mean, if you have a hoarse voice for 2 days associated with a cold and it goes away, it's probably not a big deal. But if something persists or there's a mass there, you should consult with your primary care doctor.
And that should be the general internist, primary care physician?
I think it feeds into many different ways in our society. It could be a pediatrician. It could be an internist. These days, the gynecologist is often the only primary doctor that many women see. It's an acceptable way to feed into it as well as an internist or a family doctor.
Does it make any difference in women whether these nodules are palpated at certain times of the month? Because, you know, do they actually vary with the menstrual cycle or with hormonal replacement therapy or any other factors?
You know, I know of no data to answer that question specifically. Although you mentioned hormonal therapy, you're obviously thinking of estrogens and progesterones. But if you do give thyroid hormone, sometimes you can shrink some of these nodules. But I know of no clear relationship between estrogen and progesterone and shrinking these nodules.
And if a nodule or a mass is identified by the primary care physician, what would be the next step?
Yeah, often, but not always, these patients are then sent to an endocrinologist. An endocrinologist is an internal medicine doctor with specialty training in endocrinology. And usually at that point, they do some basic work, generally a history and physical examination, and measure some selective hormone levels, particularly a TSH that's called thyrotropin or perhaps thyroid stimulating hormone. And that can suggest the function of the thyroid gland. But in most cases, most patients will progress on to a biopsy. And that's performed with a technique that we refer to as FNA, which stands for fine needle aspiration.
Do patients need to have any form of X-ray before they go on to the biopsy? You mentioned that they have an ultrasound for the diagnosis, but do they need to have other X-rays like CAT scans?
Yeah, there's actually been a dramatic shift in how we manage these. Back, I would say, 15 years ago, many patients, perhaps most, would go into a nuclear medicine study, an I-131 study. We almost never do that in the primary management. As far as CT scans or PETs or MRI scans, those are expensive studies. They're unnecessary. They lack the sensitivity that we need. And we actually found a simple ultrasound to be the ideal study in the initial workup of a thyroid nodule.
So once a biopsy is done, then obviously the pathologist is going to play a critical role in terms of evaluating that tumor tissue or that tissue.
You know, I'm so glad you asked me to be on this show because it gives me a chance to talk about pathology and cytopathology in the art form that it is. Reading the slides from a thyroid biopsy is an art form, and there are few people who really have exquisite skills in doing that. And the subtle abnormalities that they can see under the microscope, not all people who read slides have those well-developed skills. So the quality of the person who biopsies the nodule and the person who reads it are critical to making good decisions for a patient.
So one thing that's really different about thyroid cancer compared to some of the other tumors that we treat is that we really require a piece of tissue. We're really not satisfied with a fine needle aspirate. So, and you've touched on this a little bit about the critical nature of the cytopathology. Do you often have to go on to get a bigger piece of tissue?
Yeah. Actually, the answer is yes. But when we have to go on, it usually involves more than just a piece of tissue. It usually involves an operation. So the fine needle aspirate cytology, when we get a good quality specimen, can be diagnostic of cancer. And if it unequivocally shows a cancer, we go straight to definitive surgery. We do not do any in-between steps because we have essentially 99.9% confidence in that. However, about 20% of the aspirates have what we call indeterminate cytology. And getting more tissue or a bigger core piece of tissue would not help us. We're actually forced to remove the lobe containing the thyroid gland, to actually remove a piece of the organ to answer the question whether it's malignant or benign.
And Rob, are there any specific types of thyroid cancers that might have an increased risk for spreading beyond the local confines of the thyroid.
Yeah. So by definition, any thyroid cancer can spread to many areas in the body. But the different subtypes I mentioned earlier have different rates of spread to different systems. For instance, papillary carcinoma of the thyroid spreads to lymph nodes very early in its course, whereas others, such as follicular, have a more of a bloodstream spread to other areas, such as the lungs or perhaps the bones. Medullary cancer of the thyroid tends to stay localized to the local area and the lymph nodes, and anaplastic can basically go anywhere and is very aggressive locally. So they each have their own flavor to them.
So a lot of times in advanced cancer, we see these patients who develop what we call an unknown primary. They present with a cancer of indeterminate origin, and in some cases, that actually turns out to be a thyroid cancer. So how often do you see thyroid cancer presenting as an unknown primary?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Occasionally, we will see a patient who presents with a lesion somewhere else in their body, maybe their leg or their femur or a bone somewhere, and finally, we get enough tissue, and the pathologist or cytopathologist says, you know what? This looks like a thyroid primary. Now, there are special tests they can do by measuring certain markers like thyroglobulin, and they can answer that question. If, in fact, they have widespread metastatic disease outside the thyroid gland, believe it or not, in that situation, we're actually relieved to some extent because that is a treatable cancer, perhaps not curable, but treatable. And we can then go and remove the thyroid gland and then treat those patients with radioactive iodine, and the radioactive iodine can have great efficiency in treating tumors even outside the neck and even in areas of bone. So in some ways, it's a convoluted way to get there, but sometimes it works. In addition, every once in a while, we see a patient with a thyroid nodule who actually has metastatic disease from something else, particularly something like renal cell carcinoma that goes to the thyroid gland, and occasionally that can cause a real diagnostic dilemma for us, figuring out what's going on.
Now, Rabbi, I guess that's why the I-131 scans were so much in vogue, because people used that as a way to see if maybe the thyroid tumor had spread outside the thyroid.
They do. But of course, we use a lot of I-131 probes and scans once we've removed the thyroid gland. Can I digress to I-131 for just a moment?
Sure.
Because in the treatment of thyroid cancer, there are really three functional treatments. The first is surgery. We remove the tumor. The second is we use I-131. I'll discuss it in a little bit more detail. And the third is we administer thyroid hormone long-term to suppress the pituitary secretion of TSH. But what's so exciting about I-131, Ed, is that it's a magic bullet. Because the way thyroid hormone is made, it's made from 3 molecules of iodine or 4 molecules of iodine, resulting in T3 and T4. But because it's so concentrated in thyroid-producing cells, we can then administer radioactive iodine like a magic bullet and have tumor-kill ratios that are so advantageous with such little toxicity to normal tissues. It's a wonderful thing that we have for the thyroid gland, and part of the reasons our patients do so well. If only we had such a thing for other tumors that was so specific for the cancer that we treat.
So is the I-131 therapy equally effective for all the different types of thyroid cancer?
No, it's not. And as you might predict, the more differentiated thyroid tumor is, that is, the more it's like normal, the more likely the I-131 is to work. And it's exactly as such. So papillary cancers are very effectively treated. Folliculars, fairly well, but a little less so. Hurdle cells, a little bit much less likely. And finally, anaplastics, probably a waste of time. It doesn't work in almost any of those patients.
Rob, I know we're already beginning to talk about the different treatment strategies, but I guess one thing, it might be good to refresh our memories, is there any kind of genetic component to the development of thyroid cancer?
Yeah, there sure is. And so most thyroid cancers are sporadic, and there is no clear genetic component. There is a risk factor for radiation therapy. But there are clear families that have thyroid cancer. And for instance, medullary thyroid cancer, the third type that I mentioned earlier, occurs in three settings in the familial setting. It occurs in isolated familial medullary thyroid cancer. It occurs in a syndrome that we refer to as MEN2A and MEN2B. MEN means multiple endocrine neoplasia. And these, all three of those are autosomal dominant patterns, which means half the children's, boys or girls, will be affected by the disease by a random event during conception. And so 50% of the children will inherit this gene. And once they inherit the gene, the likelihood of developing thyroid cancer in their lifetime approaches 100%.
Wow.
And we have a genetic screening test for these children. So now when we have a family, and we usually know who these families are, shortly after birth, we can screen the child's blood and tell the parents with virtually 100% confidence that, yes, your child will develop thyroid cancer in their lifetime.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that information, and I'd like to talk a little bit more in detail about that as well as other therapies for thyroid cancer when we return after the break. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'm here discussing thyroid cancer with Dr. Robert Utelsman.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2009, there'll be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and about 2,400 patients will be diagnosed here in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. But when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. Robert Utelsman, Chairman in the Department of Surgery at the Yale School of Medicine, and we're here today talking about thyroid cancer. So we talked a little bit about familial thyroid cancer and detecting, using a genetic test, detecting people in the family that are prone to develop this. Can you just spend 1 minute telling us what kind of screening tests should be done on those family members?
Yeah. Well, it's really fortunate for us that we now have a sensitive blood test. So a child or anybody in the family, even potentially a parent of someone with this, we just simply draw peripheral blood. That blood is sent to a special laboratory, and the genetic test, which in this case is called a RET proto-oncogene, can be screened. And the sensitivity is very high, but not 100%.
Do those children then go on to get frequent ultrasounds of their thyroid?
Yeah, they could, but we also have other tumor markers in this case. In this case, medullary thyroid cancer makes a very specific marker called calcitonin. It also makes another marker which is less sensitive and specific, which is called CEA. But if the calcitonin level is elevated, we know these children have already at minimum C-cell hyperplasia and more likely disease in the form of cancer. But it doesn't really matter, because once they have the genetic abnormality, we now are recommending prophylactic surgery at certain ages once we know they have the genetic abnormality. And this is an example of where, because of a genetic screening test, we can now do prophylactic or preemptive surgery and prevent cancers from developing in the first place.
Well, that's really pretty impressive. So maybe let's go back towards the therapeutic options. So again, the most common type of thyroid cancer is papillary thyroid cancer?
Yes.
And the typical approach in that setting would be?
So a patient presents with a nodule, and usually that patient will then go on to a fine needle aspiration biopsy. And in papillary cancer, the fine needle aspiration techniques are very sensitive. So usually we get a diagnosis, and it's positive. The next question is, what's the next step? Well, in our hands, we recommend at minimum for all patients with biopsy-proven papillary thyroid cancer, at minimum a total thyroidectomy, removing the entire thyroid gland. But there is a big debate in the world right now about whether or not we should also be doing routine lymph node dissections in what we call the central neck. And I'd like to, I just mentioned for a sec that we're in the process of designing a randomized prospective trial to address this very question. Because experts in the field, in their heart of hearts, don't know whether it's the best or not to do in individuals who have no evidence of lymph node disease, but whether we should still take those lymph nodes out. Because as you might imagine, nothing comes for free. And if you just routinely remove lymph nodes, you're more likely to also cause injury, mm-hmm. such as to the parathyroid glands or to the nerves to the vocal cords. So to do the proper study, you have to randomize patients to yes and no treatments.
So Rob, I was actually going to ask you that question. Could you talk a little bit about the complications from a total thyroidectomy?
Yeah, I sure can. First, I'd like to mention to you that there's a clear relationship between the experience of the surgeon and the frequency of complications. And it's so fundamental to everything everything that we do. But the most common significant complications after thyroid surgery are injury to the nerves to the vocal cords, and that would result in a hoarse voice that might sound something like this. Whereas the other complication is injuries to the parathyroid glands, and the parathyroid glands are glands that sit next to the thyroid gland and control calcium metabolism. Now, we can replace those with vitamin D and calcium, but if you do that to a five-year-old child and they don't have normal calcium metabolism, that child will never grow normally. So the risks in the children are actually greater than in the adults.
And in the old days, a lot of times, along with the thyroid, the parathyroids would also be taken out. But now you really try to preserve the parathyroids.
Yeah, so we go to great trouble to preserve the parathyroids. And in fact, the best thyroid surgeons are also very good parathyroid surgeons. You know, they live in the same neighborhood, but they actually have very different functions. But they're intimately associated with each other because of their blood supplies.
So if a patient doesn't respond, say, to the radioactive iodine, and they have persistent or metastatic thyroid disease, thyroid cancer, what do you do at that point?
Well, that starts a staging workup. First of all, we can also measure something else called thyroglobulin to measure the amount of disease that they have. If we have imageable disease, for instance, if we have lymph nodes in the neck and we know they have disease, we might consider going back and doing surgery, because in 2 or 3 hours in the operating room, we can remove more tumor than you can kill with I-131. I-131 is very good for microscopic or small disease, but for gross or what we call macroscopic disease, surgery is better. In other areas, such as a weight-bearing extremity, surgery in combination with radiotherapy or other treatments would be considered. The goal, of course, is sometimes we can remove all the disease, but there are critical areas that we can't because it would cause so much destruction to normal tissues.
And Rob, is there ever any role for external beam radiation therapy to the neck?
There is. External radiotherapy will kill any rapidly dividing cells, including thyroid tissues. But of course, external beam isn't intelligent like I-131, mm-hmm. Not to demean it, but what it will do is it'll also destroy other tissues, like the tissues in the esophagus or other tissues. So the complication rate associated with that is higher than with I-131. In addition, the patients get what we call a woody, indurated neck. It's very firm and fixed, and it makes subsequent surgery difficult or at times impossible.
So when we think about chemotherapy approaches for thyroid cancer, traditionally we've thought that chemotherapy doesn't really work very well. Are there any novel approaches that are being developed?
Yeah. So for the most part, as you stated, chemotherapy is not a mainstream treatment, and that's why endocrinologists tend to manage these patients the most. But we have two great interests in clinical trials right now at the Yale Cancer Center. One is in the treatment of advanced medullary thyroid cancer, and the other one is that very rare form of anaplastic thyroid cancer. There are two open protocols right now. The medullary thyroid cancer involves a new type of a drug, and early results look very promising in this trial. These are for patients who don't have a good surgical option.
Are these new drugs small molecules, like we've talked a lot about angiogenesis molecules and signal transduction inhibitors? Are those types of therapies pertinent in thyroid cancer?
They sure are. And in fact, in the medullary cancer trial, it's a tyrosine kinase receptor type molecule to block these receptors. And the beauty of this particular trial is the toxicity profile is very low compared to more traditional forms of chemotherapy. So the preliminary results are pretty exciting.
Again, I guess what's really fascinating about the small molecule is that it's targeted specifically at the pathway that's responsible for the development of medullary carcinoma of the thyroid.
Absolutely. And I'd also like to say this is a good example where one of our surgeons, Julianne Sosa, worked with one of the oncologists, Harry Deshpande, as well as with our other colleagues. It's a true multidisciplinary approach to the treatment of thyroid cancer. And I think that's exactly what the Yale Cancer Center does so well, when you bring different groups of people in with various expertise to treat these tumors. Because from the patient's perspective, they just want to know they're getting the best care in the world.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about any quality of life issues for patients who have thyroid cancer, and as they move through this process with surgery and radioactive iodine? Now, what are the kinds of issues that patients face?
You know, there are a lot of issues they face. Of course, surgery is a relative negative, but it's a short duration event. So you come and you get an operation and you go home, and most patients are very happy with that. Sometimes we do things like thyroid hormone withdrawal, where we take away their thyroid hormone, we make them hypothyroid before we give them radioactive iodine. Some patients don't like that. And there's a new technique where we actually stimulate them with synthetic TSH and then give them the radioactive iodine treatment, and I believe that will become more and more common in the future. The radioactive iodine is not a difficult thing to do. It's almost always done now as an outpatient. The only issues there is protecting, for instance, children in the house to make sure we don't expose them to radioactivity. The other forms of treatment, for instance, chemotherapy, do have some consequences to it, but for the most part, the great majority of patients with thyroid cancer will be cured of their disease, or if not cured, they will live with a low-grade indolent disease, and most of them will actually have a normal lifespan.
Now, Rob, are there any potential concerns with the use of radioactive iodine, say, you know, long-term consequences pertaining to the development of secondary cancers?
Yeah, Ed, as usual, you're right on the money. And the more radioactive iodine you get, the more the complexity and the more complications you'll have. So yes, as you approach higher and higher doses, and at a ballpark that's about 1,000 millicuries, you will see other cancers develop, particularly leukemias. And you wouldn't be surprised by that because the radioactive iodine can go to the bloodstream. So as we start upping our doses, we start to get more and more concerned and start thinking about alternative therapies.
So if a patient has radioactive iodine and their disease go into remission, and then, say, a couple of years later, it comes back again, can they get radioactive iodine a second time?
And second, a third, and even a fourth. And there are different ways of modeling how much to give. So yes, it can be repeated multiple times.
And just kind of a curious question, do the thyroid tumor cells ever become resistant to the radioactive iodine?
Yeah, they do, and that's a problem for us. So as a ballpark figure, we talk about well-differentiated thyroid cancer, which basically means papillary, follicular, and sometimes medullary, but roughly 85% of those take up the radioactive iodine. Of course, that means that 15% don't. And as you go further and further in treatment, it's as if the radioactive iodine kills out the sensitive cells and the resistant cells remain, and then they become the predominant cells. So yes, tumors will lose their ability to take up the radioactive iodine, and that does create problems for us.
So can I go back and just ask another question about prevention? We talked a lot about the potential role of radiation in patients with, say, Hodgkin's disease. What about therapeutic tests such as CAT scans? So some of our patients get CAT scans every 3 months, and traditionally we do not shield the thyroid. Is that something that patients should be worried about?
I think the short answer is yes. CAT scans actually have a fairly high dose of radiation compared to a common chest x-ray, for instance. And in fact, Jim Brink, the chief of radiology at the Yale New Haven Hospital and the director of the department, has a particular interest in this area. And when I last discussed this with him, he actually thinks that we ought to be a little bit more conservative about it. The danger is patients go to one hospital, get a CAT scan, then they get recurrent kidney stones, perhaps. Some patients are getting 4 or 5 CAT scans a year. And so, yeah, over time, I do believe that radioactive exposure can accumulate in some of those patients.
And Rob, what about, obviously, you know, thyroid is removed from surgery. What's the need for thyroid hormone replacement over time?
So thyroid hormone is a requirement for life. So if you don't have a thyroid hormone, you will eventually not survive. Although you can go a very long time becoming hypothyroid. The answer is we replace all of our patients with thyroid hormones who have surgical removal of the thyroid gland. It's relatively easy to do. We give them usually a synthetic form of thyroid hormone because we can accurately calculate the dose, and we can easily monitor TSH levels to prove that they're in perfect homeostasis or in perfect balance.
So, Rob, let's just go back to that issue of the testing that could be done for the patients who may have inherited thyroid cancer. Are those blood tests pertinent also in terms of screening other populations of patients for thyroid cancer?
Yeah. So generally speaking, in the United States, we do not do wide screens of patients with these genetic screens. Although in Europe, what they do for patients with a dominant nodule, they measure a serum calcitonin level, which is a screen for medullary. The reason it's relevant is the operation that we do for medullary is somewhat more aggressive than for papillary, and the best time to do the best operation is the first operation. That is, 20% of my practice is remedial surgery. I wish that 0% was remedial surgery, because the second operation, third or fourth operations are much more difficult than the initial exposure. So there's some logic to doing it, but it's probably not cost effective in doing calcitonin screening because it's relatively expensive and it's a relatively rare disease.
Well, Rob, it's amazing how quickly the time has gone, and we'd like to thank you for joining us this evening on the show, and we look forward to having you come back to hear more about the latest advances in your thyroid cancer program.
Thank you, Ed and Francine.
You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank our guest expert, Dr. Robert Udelsman, for joining us. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.